Welcome to the latest episode of the Depot Podcast. I'm your main host for the year, William Gillis. This podcast is an initiative of Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time, or Depot for short, a transnational partnership of over 35 research centers, industrial museums, labor archives, trade unions, and other organizations across Italy, France, Germany, the UK, Canada, and the United States. Depot examines the political responses to deindustrialization, as well as its historical roots and lived experiences. We can be found online at deindustrialization.org. This podcast is about highlighting the work of Depot with monthly episodes covering a variety of topics related to deindustrialization, and we can be found on all major podcast services. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Andy Clark about his work on oral histories of aging under deindustrialization. Andy is a research associate at Newcastle University. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thanks very much for having me on, William.
Yeah, very happy to have you. Ahead of our interview, Andy recorded a 10-minute audio essay to discuss his research and introduce some of the key themes to inform our discussion.
Hello, my name's Andy Clark, and I'm a research associate at Newcastle University, as well as being an affiliate with Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time. In this issue of the podcast, I'm going to be talking about the project that I'm currently working on, which is titled Deindustrial Pasts and Present Inequalities, an Oral History of Deindustrialization and Experiences of Ageing. Funded through the UK Economic and Social Research Council's New Investigator Awards Scheme, this 30-month project is currently in the midst of the interviewing stage, so this seems an ideal opportunity to discuss the aims of the project and reflect on its progress with Depot colleagues and wider listeners to the podcast. In explaining the genesis of the project, I want to briefly outline my academic background and how I came to be leading this new research. I conducted my PhD at Strathclyde University between 2013 and 2017, working under the supervision of Professor Arthur McIver. This research, which culminated in my first book, Fighting Deindustrialisation, was fundamentally a labour history approach to factory closure and class activism in 1980s Scotland. I focused on three instances of factory shutdown where the workers launched militant campaigns of resistance through occupations or sit-ins, as they're more commonly known. These disputes are unique in experiences of deindustrialisation in a number of ways. Firstly, militant opposition was very much the exception in Britain. Secondly, the vast majority of the workers were women, allowing for an exploration of the ways in which closure and resistance are gendered. And thirdly, all of the occupations were, to some extent, successful. Through their activism, the workers prevented the full shutdown of their plant. This PhD research introduced me to the field of deindustrialisation studies, and I was heavily influenced by the work of Tim Strangleman, Sherry Lee Lincoln, Jackie Clark, Steve High and others. As well as a scholarly interest, I became, like many, passionate about understanding more about the harms, impacts and legacies of socio-economic rupture. In 2017, after a period of working on a government-funded social research project, I was appointed as a research associate with the newly established Newcastle Oral History Collective. In what was a unique and progressive approach, Newcastle University had provided the funds to establish the collective, and it was our job to lead new projects that could lead to further follow-on funding. Now, my specific role was to work with colleagues in the Faculty of Medical Sciences to develop an oral history of the 1,000 families of Newcastle, which is a birth cohort study established in 1947. Now, whilst not directly related to deindustrialisation, I was afforded the opportunity to craft and design a project that would allow for me to intersect my research interests with those of the 1,000 Families team, led by Professor of Epidemiology, Mark Pearce. The 1,000 Families study was established in the aftermath of the Second World War to research why the city of Newcastle in England had such a high rate of infant mortality and illness. Every baby born in the city during May and June 1947 was enrolled in the study, a total of 1,142 babies. Their medical records were marked with a red stamp, and they became colloquially known as the Red Spot Babies. Now, the medical study continued while the participants were in school up until around 1962, before becoming largely dormant. This was until 1997, when they turned 50, when a large follow-up was conducted, and the studies continued in various ways since then. As of 2020, there were around 600 of the original participants still engaged with the project. It was while trying to formulate a project that would combine my interest in deindustrialisation with an oral history of the red spots that I was introduced to the field of social gerontology, which is the social study of ageing. In particular, I was drawn towards critical gerontology, with its focus on the relationships between ageing and economic life and the ways in which class, gender, ethnicity and social policy contribute to well-being in later life. There's an important crossover with critical gerontology and oral history. Critical gerontologists emphasise the importance of older people's voices, narratives and experiences in understanding social justice and injustice in the ageing process. The focus is not only how people think about ageing, but how they feel about getting older and the factors that influence these experiences. My interest in critical gerontology from a deindustrialisation perspective was piqued through the notion of cumulative advantage and disadvantage. According to Heather Fuller Iglesias, multiple disadvantages have a cumulative effect on outcomes in later life, including in subjective well-being, physical and mental health, life expectancy, financial security, living environment and social connectivity, as well as a range of other factors. Amanda Grenier outlines how experiences related to work, poverty, unemployment earlier in life have significant impacts on precarity in older age, arguing for the need to understand life course trajectories. The connections between this work and the focus of deindustrialisation studies became apparent to me while putting together this project. It appeared to me that scholars in these distinct fields are analysing very similar issues, but are not in dialogue with one another, and it is this interconnectedness that my work aims to explore through pulling together strands in epidemiology, critical gerontology, oral history and deindustrialisation. At least one thing I can never be accused of is not being attentive to interdisciplinarity. And the aims of the project are representative of these. Firstly, on a practical level, I'm conducting an oral history of the Thousand Families birth study. Through interviewing those who have participated for 76 years, I'm collecting data on their memories of being a red spot in childhood, reflections on their involvement over the life course, as well as collecting broader life histories of the baby boomers of Newcastle. These interviews will be added to the archives of the Thousand Families study, adding a new layer of subjective narrative data to the extensive medical records that have been collected since 1947. But it's the intersection of deindustrialisation and well-being in later life that is a key academic focus of this work. The primary research question is, what role, if any, does deindustrialisation play in contributing to cumulative advantage and disadvantage in narratives of ageing in later life? Here, I'm interested in understanding whether we can isolate experiences of deindustrialisation in the 1970s, 80s and 90s and understanding how a subsample of the red spots reflect on their experiences of ageing and well-being in later life. Drawing on Sherry Lee Lincoln's notion of the half-life of deindustrialisation, I'll interrogate the legacies of manufacturing contraction over the short, medium and long term among a group of participants who have lived through this period of acute social change. I've selected Thousand Family Study participants who were employed in industrial work through their life course and have conducted first interviews with 28 participants. These first interviews were very much open-ended, subjective life history conversations with little thematic structure or intervention on my part. In the early new year, I'll return to the interviewees for a follow-up session that will hone in on experiences of deindustrialisation, focusing on the ways that the interviewees reflect on how it has or has not shape their ageing process and the accumulation of advantage or disadvantage in later life.
So with that introduction out of the way, can you tell us a bit more about the Thousand Families of Newcastle? Why was it created?
Yeah, so the Thousand Families of Newcastle started off very much as a birth cohort study, began in 1947, as I said in the introductory piece. The main
impetus for its origin was the high level of infant mortality and morbidity that existed in the city of Newcastle in the years leading up to the Second World War. They'd originally planned to begin the project in the late 1930s, but the outbreak of war obviously put a stop to that. So once wartime had ended and you've got the kind of post-war boom, medics at the Sir James Spence Institute, which was linked to the University of Newcastle at the time, started to revisit the problem and the issues of illness and infection in babies and young children, really aiming to understand what were some of the social, environmental and economic factors that could explain the high levels of infant mortality and morbidity. Newcastle, since the Industrial Revolution, was a very industrialised city, really around the industries of coal mining and shipbuilding. So there were high levels of inequality, areas of extreme wealth, but also areas of extreme poverty. So the one thing that made this, the 1,000 families, really interesting is it was a complete sample of the city's population that wasn't divided up on lines of class or ethnicity or location. It was every baby that was born in the city across the months of May and June 1947 were enrolled in the study so that they could analyse differences between geographical location, housing quality, standard of life, class, income and things like that. So that was the main idea behind it, and it was really to understand to tackle these kind of the great social ills, the social evils that were kind of being talked about in Britain at this time with the kind of creation of the health service and a more complete welfare state. So it was that epidemiological, purposeful sample of every baby that was born to understand what factors influenced their health, their well-being. And it was also incredibly subjective. So the families were visited by healthcare professionals, and it was very much of its time. It was comments on the how the mother behaved, what the father was like. Did they drink too much? Where did they work? It was very much trying to create a holistic sense of what contributes to health and well-being in babies and young children. And the really interesting thing for my project is it's now also almost doing the opposite end of the life spectrum. It's thinking about what contributes to health, well-being in the kind of aging process 76 years later on.
Yeah, this is a very fascinating little bit of a project in terms of both as like connected to the administrative welfare state and what then this provides researchers later, because your project is looking at perhaps something they didn't consider at all. So what other research other than yours has this project produced?
In the early stages of the study, it was really quite revolutionary in how it identified things like poverty, poor housing, inequality as being instrumental in understanding childhood development. That seems very simplistic and obvious, particularly to kind of social historians like us, but it did demonstrate that things like damp, overcrowded living conditions had a demonstrative impact on health and well-being amongst the city's youth population in particular. So in the first few years, there were several publications related to how living conditions impacted and influenced young people's chances and health and well-being. And so much so that the project was only ever designed to last for the first 5 years of the children's life. But because of the significance of the early findings, it was then extended to follow them through their entire schooling career. So that was the main publications that came from it originally. It was focused on the city of Newcastle, its physical environment, its wage structure, and how this would impact on the health and well-being of the population. Once the study kind of drew to a close, once the children left school, there were a couple of small, very small follow-up studies conducted, but it wasn't until 1997, when they had the 50th anniversary follow-up, that much more research was done. And I think some of the main things that have came from the study include the link between diabetes and calorie control. So that's something that Newcastle University has been at the forefront of in terms of demonstrating that if you're pre-diabetic or if you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, that by taking part in a kind of ultra low controlled calorie that you can actually reverse the diabetes. So that came from that 1997-2007 study, when they kind of reanalyzed the red spots and discovered those with diabetes and then tried something quite different in terms of what was common practice up to then in terms of managing type 2 diabetes. A project that was done a few years ago by a colleague of mine, Joe Wildman, looked specifically at retirement trajectories. So that was, I think, 2018 for her PhD thesis. And it was really interesting because she was looking, again, at a kind of purposeful sample of the 1,000 families to look at when people retired, why they retired, and what they did post-retirement, how they filled their time, and how that then kind of influenced and impacted their health and well-being in later life. Like many medical studies, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of publications that have come from the 1,000 Families cohort, things that have looked on in terms of speech therapy, in terms of dentistry was quite interested in it, in terms of looking at the teeth of the kind of first NHS generation and how that impacted through the life course. So there's been really substantial use of the study, if you like, particularly in the medical setting. But this is the first time where it's really got that kind of social, economic, historical context, that subjective aspect where what we're trying to do or what I'm trying to do in this study is to allow the 1,000 family members to reflect on their life course and subjectively analyse how changes across their life influence where they are as they're kind of heading towards their ninth decade, if you like.
Yeah, so that does sound very fascinating, and particularly that there's so much medical history and medical research been done on this cohort.
Yeah.
So your primary research question does kind of follow into the medical history aspect of this, and it's about this idea of cumulative advantage and disadvantage, and particularly the role that deindustrialization has played in how people age. Can you expand on this and kind of explain what these concepts of cumulative advantage and disadvantage are?
Absolutely. It was something that once I started kind of reading the literature jumped out to me as someone who's done a lot of work in deindustrialization, particularly thinking about notions of the half-life and the kind of longer term ramifications on health, on the body and the mind, but also on kind of the geography of deindustrial communities, if you like. So the concept of cumulative cumulative advantage really attunes to what happens over the life course that gives advantage or disadvantage later on. So it's the idea that throughout our lives, things happen to us, or we do things, we make choices, or choices are made for us that impact our health, our well-being, our income, our prosperity. And it's about trying to isolate those to understand how those then play out in later life. So, for example, if you're someone who worked in a coal mine for the majority of your career, you may have accumulated advantage in terms of good wage, in terms of earning well, particularly through kind of boom periods. You might have accumulated property, you might be able to buy your house, pay off your mortgage, that kind of thing. So you've accumulated material advantage in some ways, but you may also have significant lung problems and breathing difficulties. So you've accumulated health disadvantage, and these things kind of intersect with one another in explaining your experiences of old age and later life. But also, of course, that's for those who do make it to older age and later life experiences, which is something that I've been kind of thinking about. I'm interviewing people who are in their late 70s, which is kind of coming up to just about or beyond the average life expectancy in a place like Newcastle. But one of the aspects that really interests me when I started looking into the social gerontological literature around advantage and disadvantage was they seem to be talking about deindustrialization, but not using the language that we would use, people in Depo would use, or other kind of scholars. They talked about on periods of unemployment through the life course, how that impacts later on, periods of poverty, periods of hardship. Now, those of us that have done historical work on deindustrialization would instantly kind of link that process and its impact on health, mental health impacts, physical health, poverty, inequality. And it very much seemed that we were discussing similar things, similar aspects, similar factors, but not in the same kind of language. So the main aim in the project from a kind of academic standpoint is to try and draw those links between the field of gerontology, which looks at this advantage that's cumulative over the life course, and the work that we do looking at historic deindustrialization, but then its longer term ramifications and impacts, and to try and isolate, if possible, deindustrialization specifically as a factor in explaining cumulative advantage or disadvantage. Interestingly, when I first started the project, coming from my own background, I very much assumed, and you should never assume in these things, but the hypothesis very much was, well, yeah, if you went through deindustrialization and the kind of experience of brutality in the 70s and 80s, that's going to have had a disadvantage impact on you later on in life. But that's maybe not necessarily what I'm finding in the fieldwork that I've been doing, and I know we'll get questions about that later on, but that's the kind of main thing that's flagging up, that my hypothesis might have been completely incorrect. And actually, the people that I'm speaking to at this moment in time, because of the historic periodization of deindustrialization, their experience of manufacturing closure might just contribute to being an advantage in their later life, which is kind of what I've been spending my Christmas break trying to wrestle around in my head, because there's nothing worse than the hypothesis. It's fascinating when it goes against your original kind of expectations, but it's also a bit of a plays in the mind a little bit when it's not quite lining up the way you thought it would.
Yeah, when your findings don't seem to agree with what you think is a fairly obvious research question.
Yeah.
So you mentioned social gerontology, and also in your introductory audio essay, you had talked about this idea of critical social gerontology as an approach. Can you explain what that looks like in practice?
Absolutely. Critical gerontology emerged in the Western world pretty much through the 70s and 80s, the kind of the era of Margaret Thatcher, of Ronald Reagan, of neoliberalism, of the society is dead, long live the individual. So again, if we're looking at deindustrialization, again, the chronology of the literature ties up as well, because it was at this point where older people were seen as a burden. Those who were aging were costing money, they were wasting resources when they weren't actually economically productive. No, it's looking at the individual as a commodity, as a producer, as a consumer, whereas when people are in their 60s, 70s and 80s, they increasingly become, you know, recipients of welfare, recipients of support and healthcare and things like that. So critical gerontology really pushed back against this idea of seeing older people as a problem, and stressed the importance of agency amongst older people. What do older people want in a society that they live in? What would benefit them? What would an age-sensitive community look like? You know, how can we, rather than just treat old people as an issue to be dealt with, how can we bring them into the kind of conversations about the future of society and how that can be changed to improve the lives of everyone, not just those who are contributing to the economy? So it was very much the kind of Marxist approach to seeing people as beyond just simply producers and consumers, and trying to understand changes in society that would influence well-being amongst older people. And as I mentioned in the audio essay, it really draws in with oral history, which is my other kind of disciplinary background, because it privileges the voice of older people rather than treating them. And you see this in current contemporary dialogue, you see this quite a lot. It treats older people as people who are talked about. You know, what are we going to do about older people, rather than kind of speaking with those who are undergoing the aging process to understand what it is they want, what their needs are, what their wants are, what their desires are. And the other interesting aspect for this for me was I had got the funding for this project in December 2020. Yeah, it was. So I was writing the funding application during the first kind of serious lockdown of the kind of COVID-19 pandemic, and just being on Twitter and following people who I knew from critical gerontology literature, you've seen this play out in real time. You've seen this kind of idea of older people as a problem, and particularly in the UK discourse around COVID. Oh, it's only something that will kill older people. It's only something that will hurt older people. We can't close down the economy just to protect older people. And critical gerontologists were really engaged in this. People like Professor Tom Scharf, who's just recently retired from Newcastle, you know, he was kind of linking this back to the work they were doing in the 70s and 80s, saying, you know, things might have changed in terms of better awareness around ageing and well-being, but when push comes to shove, when there's a massive crisis and health catastrophe that impacts and influences older people more, the same narratives of, well, we can't stop everything for younger people in order to keep older people safe. So that was an interesting real-time example of what critical gerontologists talk about and discuss in terms of older people and their positionality in society. So that was very much where, again, looking at deindustrialization literature and my own background, having consistently interviewed older people about their experience of historic factory closure and how that's influenced and impacted their life since then, it seemed to me to be a reasonable line to just kind of draw that further out and to look at, well, look at aging process and specifically, what does it, you know, to take Tim Strangleman's kind of famous quote, you know, how does it feel and what does it mean to live in a deindustrializing society as you're becoming a much older person and as you've lived through that over a number of decades? That's the kind of the crux of where the project is.
This is a bit speculative, but you mentioned COVID and its impact on social gerontology. Mm. And I wonder if there's any sort of intersection between this and industrial and deindustrialization in what's been happening, but maybe you might catch some of that in your project. So you'd also mentioned in your little introductory essay that you were using a subsample of the red spots, since there's over 600 who are still participating, so that'd be quite a bit of people to talk to. And specifically, this subsample was industrial workers. So why did you choose them specifically to look at deindustrialization?
I mean, firstly, I wish that I did have the funding, time, resources to interview the full 600, because it would be a hell of a project to do. So the reason I narrowed it down to those who had worked in industry was really to tie it into that kind of main research question, looking to speak with people who had trained as engineers, as miners, who had worked in these industries and lived through the kind of downsizing of Britain's manufacturing economy. That's the primary group that I want to speak with, but I've also been speaking with and interviewing those who worked in industries associated to that, particularly people who worked in pubs and restaurants and bars, kind of trying to get the holistic sense of deindustrialization and its kind of multifaceted impacts. And the way that we chose the people to interview, it was really interesting. The data in terms of the spreadsheet of the 1,000 families, I gave to one of my colleagues in the medical school a very broad parameters of who I wanted to speak to. So it was, people who'd worked in industry. It was also people who'd experienced downward social mobility between 77 and 97, because that was something that they'd tried to capture in the data collected then. So again, looking at people who'd become poorer during that period of, you know, accelerated industrial contraction. And really, I passed it over to the colleagues in the medical school who ran the formulae and all the things that people can do in Excel, which is definitely beyond my comfort zone. And they just sent me back study numbers with very limited snapshots of who these people were. So I still didn't know who the people were at this time. But I could see that they were born, the area they were born in, where they currently live, what their job was in 1967, 97, 2007, and a little bit of biographical detail about them. So essentially, I just picked the ones that were most interesting and most relevant to the study. So for example, one person in 1997 was working in a food production factory, and by 2007 they were working as a cleaner in a school. So that's kind of, that seems interesting, what's happened over that kind of 10-year period where someone's working in production that's now working in the service sector, the kind of things that would be of interest to understanding deindustrialization. A lot of the demographics were selected for me. So of course, everyone was born in 1947. Everyone's white. Everyone's white British, which I think I mentioned the audio essay on wanting to try and counter with a second cohort. And I think by pure chance, there's a pretty even gender split amongst the people that I'm interviewing. I would have to double check my spreadsheet, but having done 30 interviews, it definitely doesn't feel, as I'm sitting here reflecting on the last few months of fieldwork that I've been interviewing, and particularly more men or more women. So that's how we came up with that purposeful sample. As I said, 30 was the number, the kind of golden number that I was hoping for. The one good thing about doing an oral history like this is the hardest thing in oral history is trying to get people to come forward to take part in interviews. You know, you can try advertising campaigns, you can try lots of things. Whereas I was very fortunate that I had everyone's address and contact details, and they had been involved in this project since 1947, so it wasn't something that was kind of coming out of the blue. So I think in total, I sent out 100 letters and received around about 35 to 40 responses, which even just thinking about it from a social science perspective is a massive positive response to asking people to take part in a study. You know, you're talking about 30, 40%. Some people got back in touch with me to say they couldn't take part or wrote back on behalf of their partners who perhaps had poor health. And a couple of cases wrote back to tell me that the person I tried to contact had passed away. Because that's something that is not updated in the study anymore due to kind of changes in data protection legislation. But the vast majority of those who got back to me were more than happy to sit down to do the interviews, which is a kind of, this has gone off on a tangent slightly, but it is another aspect, particularly the medical school colleagues are interested in, is why are people who have been involved in health studies, who started them in the kind of 40s and 50s, so interested and eager to keep taking part, whereas they have a real problem with drop-off for more recent birth studies. As soon as people come to 18, they're much less inclined to take part and much more eager to kind of to stop the participation. So it's really interesting that these folks are so keen and so eager. And that became my first question in the first interview, just basically, why did you agree to this? Why did you, when you got this letter through, why was it something that you said, yeah, I'll do that, not a problem? Because I think that's really interesting from the historian's point of view as well, how people who have been medical subjects, if you like, their entire life, are still so eager and keen to kind of take part and to contribute and to be involved in this kind of project. So that's how we recruited the cohort. As I said, it's exclusively white British, so one of the things we're hoping to do as we go into 2024 is to recruit a subsample of first and second generation migrants who moved to Newcastle or whose families moved to Newcastle, particularly in the 60s and 70s when there was mass migration from the kind of former British colonies, and to try and understand their experiences of deindustrialisation, not only as industrial workers, but as migrating industrial workers, the things they might have faced in terms of racism and poverty, and to think about how that then impacts the cumulative advantage or disadvantage that we're trying to isolate. That's going to be incredibly tough because Newcastle has historically had quite a very small ethnic population, so it's about trying to make those connections in a way that would be meaningful to interviewees as well as to me. But there are certainly community groups that I've got pre-existing relationships with that would hopefully be able to speak to and to try and involve them in the study as well. But the other problem is that the industries in Newcastle were also incredibly white. So it might be not so possible to find people who experienced deindustrialisation on the front line, but it might be more reasonable to interview folks who experienced the kind of after effects of deindustrialisation, who were first or second generation migrants. So that's how I'm trying to put together as representative a kind of sample of interviewees as possible. But if it's not truly representative, which is very difficult in oral history research, generally it should still be able to say a lot about changes in, you know, Newcastle society and economic function over the last 50, 60 years, and how that now impacts on people who are becoming much older.
Well, in terms of the industrial workers, my question then is, what are the sort of major industries in Newcastle? You mentioned coal mining and you mentioned manufacturing, but could you give us, I guess, a bit more detail about the kinds of industrial work that people did in Newcastle?
Absolutely. So mining, particularly the kind of counties round about Newcastle, County Durham and places like Chesley Street, they were dominated by mining. Newcastle and County Durham were kind of populated by small little mining villages. And the city of Newcastle itself, no, it's a river city. You know, the river kind of flows through the middle of Newcastle and Gateshead. And that was very much shipbuilding. So massive shipyards like Swan Hunters on the River Tyne, very much an engineering-dominated city. But in terms of the people that I've interviewed, a real wide variety of not only trades that they were involved in, but also workplaces. So I've interviewed three people who worked in sewing factories, and I knew very little about the kind of sewing trade and the textile trade in Newcastle. Food production was quite significant, particularly in the 50s and 60s. And But beyond that, it's very much people who worked as mechanics, as electricians, as platers, as welders, in the kind of engineering industries related to either coal mining or shipbuilding. Those are the main dominant kind of forms of work in Newcastle. But I've also interviewed quite a few people who moved away from Newcastle. So I've travelled around Britain speaking to people who, in the period since birth, obviously have moved away from the city. And that's very much a story of declining opportunities in the north of England, so heading towards the south of England, where kind of industry was relocating to, or where the auto industry was kind of based on the Midlands of England and further south. So it is very much a story of inward migration following the work as well. But one of the things that is interesting, as I said, about kind of running counter to my initial hypothesis, is that many people who did have a trade, who were trade skilled workers, you know, they might have been an electrician in the shipyard, but once the shipyard closed, they were able to find work elsewhere. They were able to go elsewhere with their trade and find work, which I think's an interesting aspect of deindustrialisation that certainly I've not thought about much, and I'm not sure is really widely captured in the literature. We tend to think of people who are, you know, one trade specific to one industry, but of course you've got people who are trained in all sorts of, you know, painting and decorating, civil engineering, electrician work, and they can kind of retrain themselves when their specific industry closes and take those skills and the work that they do to other places.
Yeah, that is a very interesting point about this transferable skills and migrating to other find other work. I mean, certainly the area I study, Cape Breton Island, out-migration has been a very, very big part of the deindustrialization experience. And this question of migration and deindustrialization is something I'm interested in, would like to do a bit more, although that would be sort of outside the scope of my master's. But certainly that has been a big thing, that people get these particular skill trades and then they leave because the previous industry, which in Cape Breton was mostly coal mining and steel, this closes, and then people move to places like Alberta or Ontario and find other work using their skilled trades there. So in terms of these interviews, how have the interviews been so far? And what kind of interview style have you used?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, I've done the first group of interviews. So everyone's been will be interviewed on a minimum of two occasions. And that's an approach that I've kind of developed or used more over the last number of years, working with Graham Smith at the Oral History Unit. So these first interviews have been very much open life history, subjective interviews, starting with the kind of the first main question is, you know, tell me about yourself, to allow the interviewee the opportunity to explain their life story in their words in a way that they're comfortable with, to touch on the things they want to touch on, with very little probing or prompting from me. There's maybe three or four questions that I want to ask during that first interview, but that's very much kind of setting up for the second interview. Things like, what did you work as? You know, if they don't cover that in the initial kind of part, then I'll ask that. Or, you know, how has the area changed over the last 40, 50 years? And how does it feel to be living in this area as someone who's getting older? That's the kind of all I've really asked. So it's been very much interviewee-led, allowing them to highlight the aspects of their life course and their experience that they place importance and significance onto. And, you know, to very much, although it's almost kind of cliche, it's to let them speak in their own words about their life and their experiences. In the early new year, I'll go back and I'll be much more kind of forensic interviewer, if you like. So what I'll be doing is generating a much more detailed and structured interview schedule that will align both to their life, so it'll be specific to each person based on re-listening to the first interview, but it'll also have certain set questions in relation to this research, in relation to deindustrialization specifically and experiences of closure specifically. Because it's always, I don't like to interview someone and say, tell me what you think of deindustrialization, because that there's so many assumptions in that one question that you're putting on the interviewee. So that's very much in the first interview to let them try and explore their thoughts on social change, economic change through gentle probing. And then the second interview is much more, tell me what you think about deindustrialization, because we've already done the first part. And how the interviews have been, they've been fascinating. Though with any project, any oral history-based project, you never know what you're going to come across. You never know who you're going to come across. You never know what stories you're going to listen to. And I think the main thing that's come across from all of them is, in terms of being part of the study, is a real sense of wishing to do good. And because when I've asked the question, why have you been part of this study for so long, the kind of main response is, well, because if there's something wrong with me and they can use me as someone to identify why that's happened, if it can help someone else, then that's great. And I think there is something to that, and there is literature in kind of medical humanities and health history, particularly that first generation of NHS users, if you like, that there was a sense of, well, we can't just get this for free, we have to give something back. And that's this kind of reciprocity of, if I'm getting all this health checks free at the point of use, then it's absolutely fair game that if I'm asked to give something back, then I want to do that, I want to try and participate in some way. And I think that's something that's really interesting in terms of the health history aspect of it. One of the frustrating aspects of the first interviews, and I kind of touched on this, is deindustrialization hasn't come up much from the people that I've interviewed. I've asked around the question in terms of particularly people who worked in industry, you know, why did you leave that? What happened? How did that make you feel? Etc. But in terms of this kind of idea of contributing to severe disadvantage later in life, that hasn't come up. And there's a few reasons why I suspect that's the case that I'll follow up more in the second interviews. Firstly, as I said, there's it's a survivor bias. So everyone I'm interviewing is 76, which is a good age to be. There'll be a lot of people who experienced the sharp end of deindustrialization who were 1,000 family members who have since died, you know, kind of late 60s, early 70s. So those narratives aren't collected. So what I'll do with that is to try and kind of use the archive material to understand and analyse their experiences, the material that's been logged over the life course. The second aspect, which is the one that I'm kind of grappling with most, is that many of the people that I interviewed, yes, they lost their jobs when industry closed down, but on the flip side, they received good redundancy payments, they had established good pensions, and they were able, as I said earlier, to take their trade and work elsewhere. So in that respect, there is a cumulative advantage for some people who experienced the kind of the brutality of deindustrialization, because they were able to, not all, but some were able to use it as a kind of advantage. Many people I spoke to started their own small businesses, plumbers, electricians, pipe fitters. You know, they used the redundancy money that they got when their specific employer closed down to kind of become small businessmen, predominantly men. And I think that's really interesting, because it's perhaps this group of workers who are now 76 years old had a different experience of deindustrialization from those who came after. And that's where my thinking is at the moment. Whereas with many industries closing, it's a full brutality of rapid closure, minimum redundancy payments. When these folks lost their job due to manufacturing decline, there still appears to have been some form of moral economy of deindustrialization that, yes, this place is closing, but you are entitled to payments of X, Y, and Z. You are entitled to kind of maintain your pensions. And perhaps these workers were just before the sharp end of sudden closure with no redundancy, with no kind of support, which we associate much more with deindustrialization, particularly in the kind of mid to late 80s and early 90s. So that's what the second interviews are really going to look at, a real chronology of folks' experiences, and, you know, to ask those direct questions of how has what happened in their life contributed to where they are just now, and is it the fact that for some people deindustrialization was an advantage because it gave them opportunities that they wouldn't have had, or is that just a kind of fluke of this specific cohort? But hopefully it is adding to the complexity of our understanding of the deindustrial experience, and it isn't linear one way or the other. Because certainly I didn't expect to find to kind of interview people, and very much a good number, perhaps half of those that I've interviewed have said, oh yeah, I lost my work in the kind of mid to late 70s, but then that gave me the opportunity to go on and do something else. And you know, that's not something that I've come across in my previous work, because my previous work's very much focused on sudden closure and the kind of significant impacts that has on people, whereas perhaps for this cohort, it's a different story of deindustrialization that kind of transcends the model economy and balances between the model economy and the period of kind of rapid neoliberalization. As I say, I'll find out more about this over the next 2 or 3 months while I do the second interviews, but it has been a surprising finding for the first half of the project, but it's one that I'm really looking forward to exploring more, and to really kind of speak with people about how they talk about their advantage. Because if I'm speaking to people who are, and sometimes if you interview someone in their home, you can often tell before the interview begins if you're speaking to someone who's in a position of privilege, because you're standing outside the house that they live in. And there has been a few times during this project where it's been like, holy hell, look at the size of this place. You know, because these are people that probably bought cheap with redundancy payments from industries closing, and have kind of been able to maintain that. So it's a totally different story of deindustrialization than the ones that I've researched previously. And it's fascinating in ways that I didn't necessarily expect it to be.
Yeah, it does give point to these very diverse sets of experiences to deindustrialization, as well as you talk about like this moral economy of how particularly, I guess, the welfare state approached deindustrialization, how in some periods it was better than it would be later. Mm-hmm. And I think of, but also I think of the small business aspect, the people who sort of use their redundancy and their skills and transferred into becoming a small business owner. It almost like follows a very like Thatcherite idea of how workers were supposed to respond to this industrial closure, is that they should become self-starters and you know, entrepreneurs. And for some of them, that actually was very successful. You know, I study primarily coal and have read a fair bit about Britain's coal industry. And that was the Thatcherite approach to dealing with all of these now redundant miners, was like, oh, go start a small business. Here's your redundancy pay to do that with. And it wasn't necessarily very successful, because often these areas don't have the capability to support whatever small business this miner is supposed to create. And and also the state approaches to this, I find very fascinating. Not to get too much into my own research, but that's a question I've always had, because what I'm looking at is the closure of coal mining in Nova Scotia, where you do have this big state intervention. That instead of the sudden closure happening in 1967, you get this drawn out almost 35-year period of state ownership that sort of prevents this instantaneous collapse, but then you still have this much slower process of deindustrialization, which may have like created these more diverse experiences for people, that beyond just merely like loss and destruction. I mean, I haven't fully researched all of it yet, but I mean, that's an interesting angle that you've kind of highlighted here for me.
Yeah, and I think,
continue.
No, the one aspect that I haven't been able to tease out so far is, although many of these people have went on to, you know, become quite wealthy and quite comfortable in later life, they still live within areas that have been significantly harmed by deindustrialization, right? When we think about Lincoln's half-life notion, we're talking about areas of extreme inequality, of extreme poverty, of extreme health difficulties. And what I really want to touch on in the second group of interviews is, how do those aspects impact the lives of these people? So even if these folk had been able to do this kind of Thatcherist ideal of starting your own business and pick yourself up, they still live within an area that's one of the poorest in the UK. So do they attribute that to deindustrialization? Do they attribute that to socioeconomic change? Or do they take an individualist approach to understanding how some people fall behind, if we use that kind of language as well? I think that's going to be really interesting. But I mean, it's interesting when we talk about the Thatcher ideas. Everyone, even those that interviewed that became small business people, and there's still this kind of real reticence to talk about conservative ideas, and because it is Newcastle being a kind of traditionally very Labour centric city. So I wonder if it's almost like they kind of bought into Thatcher without agreeing with Thatcher. So maybe it could be kind of picking and choosing which parts of that they could use. But again, the one aspect of it is I am speaking to those who are still alive, and not only alive but fit enough to take part in an interview in their late 70s. So that's always going to be the kind of limitation of a project like this. When you've got a set cohort of a set age, if the first funder had given us the go-ahead 5 years ago when we first wanted to do the project, we could have asked these questions. But sadly, it took a little while to get off the ground. But yeah, and the other flip side of that is from this project, it's my hope to not only bring me into dialogue with social gerontology and Asian studies, but to internationalise this kind of idea of cumulative advantage and disadvantage through deindustrialisation studies. So you're talking about the work you do with miners in Nova Scotia. I'm thinking about the work that Lauren does with textile workers in Montreal. You know, these research questions applicable in different contexts. So that perhaps this is the situation for people in their late 70s in Newcastle, but can we take this research design and these questions and this approach and apply them to textile workers in Montreal in the 90s or coal miners in Nova Scotia in the 60s and 70s to try and build an international profile of age and well-being in later life and the kind of role of deindustrialization within that?
Yeah, that's the big thing about Depot is creating like these transnational linkages in the research.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that you found your interviews kind of challenged some of your assumptions that you came in with your research question about the role of deindustrialization and aging. So can you share any narratives that challenge this, or even also ones that you found like confirmed this, or ones that sort of don't necessarily have anything to do with either challenging or confirming?
Yeah, and I think it goes back on to what we were just talking about, is folks who have done very well financially despite working in declining and contracting industries, people who reflect on deindustrialization or workplace closures as being something that had advantages for them, that had kind of positive impacts in their life and contributed to improved well-being. So again, this all goes kind of counter to what my thoughts were when I began the project. But I think the main thing that's kind of struck me is when discussing the areas that the folk live in. So as I said earlier, the last question that I asked in every first interview, which was to set up for the second interview, was how has the area you live in changed over the last 30, 40, 50 years? And almost exclusively, everyone has talked about the decline of their immediate physical vicinity. But they haven't attributed it to economic change, which has been interesting. They haven't attributed it to rising unemployment, decreasing good work, decreasing real wages, increased inequality, widening gaps between rich and poor. It's been very much blamed on not so much individual behaviour, but blamed on, discussed through their perception of social decline. So it's the idea of community not being what it once was, but in trying to understand the reasons for that, there's been a lot of vagueness and kind of blaming what I would see as not what should be blamed. So there's been a lot of kind of discussion around simple things like litter in the streets or kind of decline in urban environment, but in discussing those, it's not been through the lens of social investment or welfare investment. It's been very much through the lens of people who live in areas are making them worse than they were once were. And it's interesting because it's almost the kind of idea of people who benefited from a lot blaming others who are benefiting from nowhere near what they had. So there's been a lot of kind of comment about people who rely on welfare support, on the welfare state, despite these interviewees kind of being the first generation who really benefited from a welfare state. And that's kind of seen as a problem. So the really interesting aspect has been, who do people blame for the condition their communities are in? Why do they blame those factors and not other factors? So in the second interviews, it's going to be interesting because I want to probe that further. But as an oral historian, you can't really get into a debate with your interviewee because the whole point is to understand their perspective and where they're coming from. So that's what I said about kind of developing a nuanced interview schedule that kind of allows for an exploration of some of these complaints from the interviewees about the current society and current social makeup, if you like, but in a way that allows to understand why they came to those views, when they came to those views, and how they articulate those. So one of the things that I'm doing for that, which I've never done before, but it's quite necessary, I think, is I'm going to workshop this problem. So in the second week in January, I'm hosting a workshop with oral historians from Newcastle University and kind of across the region. And I'm going to kind of probe some of the issues and the problems that I've had in these first interviews in terms of how people reflect on social change and who they blame for social change, and to try and think about how do I then approach this in a second interview in a way that can garner useful material and reflection without either endorsing what they're saying, but also without explicitly challenging it. And when the interviewee may then shut down, it can become a much more protracted conversation, but also to then try and encourage the interviewee to kind of reflect on the social and the structural while discussing this kind of the individualist aspect. So the second interviews will be really interesting in terms of trying to explore all of these issues further. The first interviews have been great in terms of setting up and allowing me to understand who these people are and their kind of life experiences. But I think these second interviews are going to be fascinating and kind of really diving more deeply into these experiences of the social impacts of deindustrialization. So you'll have to get me back on in a few months and I can come and talk about what comes out of those second interviews.
Yeah, we could certainly do that, especially since one of the sort of big questions that Depot has often had is like, these linkages between deindustrialization and right-wing populisms and how people might view the social and economic change as being connected to things like immigration.
Yeah.
And why they might blame that instead of investment decisions by states and companies. So I guess our final question, which was in your introductory audio essay, you talked about how your PhD was a more traditional labor history of deindustrialization, and now you're doing a kind of medical histories of deindustrialization. Of course, both are connected through your methodology of oral history. I find that very interesting. Like, what are these differences and similarities between these projects where you're going from a more traditional labor history to something else?
I think the main difference is in the analysis. As you say, the methodology is very similar through kind of oral history research. The interviews for the PhD project are much more focused and structured on work and specific workplaces and specific industrial labour disputes. Whereas, as I say, this project is much kind of bigger interviews and much broader and covers more ground. But I think partly through my training and also partly through how people talk in society, it comes back to work. You know, it comes back to the employment relationship. When you ask people about their life, they talk about what they did for paid employment, which is something that I'm finding really interesting through this project. It's, even though we're talking about something quite different, it's the working relationship that kind of comes to the fore. And what's been good about that is the kind of the knowledge and the experience that I gained through the PhD project and the kind of questions to ask and how to approach questions of work and the kind of sociology of work, I've been able to put those into the interviews that I'm doing in this project so that I can still gather that labour history side while also doing the kind of more medical health history side of things as well. But in terms of the differences, it's very much thinking about the interviewee as more than their work. So in the Labour History Project, it was, you're a worker, you're a trade unionist, I want to know about your work, your Labour history, how did that all kind of play a part in who you are? Whereas now, although the first interviews, there was a lot of conversation about work, I know that I have to now go back and ask questions about health and well-being, social change, economic change. So it's about asking different questions in different ways. But it's also, and maybe this is just because that's what I've used. Every project that I've done before, not just a PhD, but all my projects have been on a specific period or event or thing that's the kind of central focus of it. So the PhD book project was on specific industrial disputes. I've just finished doing a project on an oral history of the Lockerbie Pan Am 103 terrorist attack. Another one that I'd done previously was on a wartime apprenticeship scheme. So there was always a central thing that kind of bound the project together. Whereas in this project, yes, there is in terms of the health study, but that's not something that's not what the project is about. That's just how I've came across people. So I've found it really difficult to try and maintain a clear focus in the interviews. And again, that's why I'm workshopping for the follow-up sessions, because you're asking people about anything and everything in their life, which can, of course, go in many different ways. And it's about, well, how do I allow the interviewees to have this wide-ranging conversation about who they are, where they've been, what they've done, subjective reflection, but also keep it focused enough that I can answer the primary research questions of the project. That's been really tricky, because you can't write down three questions in the interview schedule that tells you how someone reflects on cumulative advantage or disadvantage through the life course in terms of deindustrialization. You know what I mean? So it's about trying to think, well, how do I get enough reflection on those through asking a series of questions, a number of different questions, in order to get that kind of level of analysis and insight, because it's not so much a question of what happened, which again, my projects have always been, how did this thing happen? What happened? What was your role? And how do you now think on it? It's much more, how has your life changed? How has society changed, and how does that now impact your role in that as an older person? So that's certainly been the big difference. And there's been times during the first interviews where I've sat listening and engaging to the person talking to me, and I've thought, I have no idea what to ask next. When they stop talking, I have no clue how to follow up, because they could be talking about anything. And that kind of gives you that sense of panic and sense of dread. So when they put their audio full stop here, I don't know what I'm going to ask next, because there's not a natural place for me to then go. I've always managed to find something, but it's not been in that kind of, so then what happened next? Then what happened, and how did that feel? So that style of, although the methodology is similar in terms of oral history, the practice of it across in this project from all of my previous projects is massively different, which has been fascinating, but challenging, which is why I said again, I'm going to workshop this to try and get expertise and support from people that have done this kind of project before. Because I think it's important to realise that if you work with other people who do similar work and use similar methodologies, that you should probably kind of try and take advantage of that expertise wherever you can. In academia, we're often kind of encouraged to go down a very individualistic project route, especially with kind of solo projects. You should do this and maybe take some advice. But I think with this being so different from what I've done before and throwing up so many fascinating issues and questions, it's very much a case of, if I can get as much input and guidance from as many people as possible, I think we'll ultimately make for a much stronger project.
Yeah, it does seem like this thousand family study is like shaping your project. Mm. Its pre-existence shapes your project as much as your research question does. Yeah. And with that, I guess, if you do want listeners to contact you with feedback, is there a way they can do that?
Oh, absolutely. My email address is andy.clark@newcastle.ac.uk. Please feel free to get in touch with anything. It would be great to hear from people that have done maybe similar work or maybe completely dissimilar work, but have got some kind of insights or ideas. Always open to discuss with the kind of wider deindustrialization community. Absolutely.
So, you mentioned you're doing another round of follow-up interviews with people, and then presumably you're going to start to put this together into some kind of final research project. What are the next steps for this project?
So I'll be doing the second batch of interviews probably across February and March. Probably just be a kind of intense period of interviewing and travelling and getting those recorded. After that, the main outputs that I'm hoping for from the research project will obviously be the kind of final project report that will be sent to the funder. We're looking to do a symposium at the British Gerontology Society conference, which is in Newcastle in July. I'll send a link to that in the show notes, because I'm hoping to compile a panel of people that are interested in deindustrialisation who are doing similar themes, that we can begin this conversation between deindustrialisation scholars and critical gerontologists. After that, there'll be a public lecture at some point in Newcastle on the broader Thousand Families project, but while also talking about this specific aspect of deindustrialisation. And beyond that, it will be no doubt hopefully 3 or 4 journal articles and a monograph to come out the back of it. But the main thing that I'm hoping to achieve through the project is to bring that closer linkage between historians and all scholars of deindustrialisation with the kind of social gerontology, aging and well-being in later life, because I think there's a crucial conversation that could be being had there that's maybe just not quite taking place at the moment. So that's the main thing that I'll be doing over kind of the second half of 2024.
Well, very interesting. You'll have to invite the social gerontology scholars to our Depot conference in Glasgow in June.
Absolutely.
So this brings us to the end of the episode, and I'd like to thank Andy very much for appearing on our show to discuss his fascinating work on these oral histories of aging and deindustrialization.
Thanks very much for having me, William.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And again, this podcast is an initiative of Depot and can be found on all major podcast services. Our website is deindustrialization.org, which is full of information about the project, and you can sign up for a monthly email newsletter. And thank you again for listening to this episode, and we'll be back again in another month. Goodbye.